From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, memories of Alligator Annie, snake hunting, and squirrel dumplings. We talk with writer Ken Wells. His new novel, Junior's Leg, is his second book set on the Louisiana bayou where he grew up. Wells is also features editor for Page One of the Wall Street Journal. Also, the sex mob does bond. We talk with trumpeter Stephen Bernstein, leader of the jazz band Sex Mob. On their new CD, they perform eccentric interpretations of music from Bond films, as well as original compositions inspired by Bond music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Mac Lee. Connecticut's governor says the early investigation into the death of a woman from inhalation anthrax is focusing on the male. The 94-year-old woman died today after spending several days in the hospital. Governor John Rowland says mail delivery is being investigated because the woman rarely traveled from her home. Postal workers are being interviewed and given antibiotics as a precaution. President Bush visited troops at Fort Campbell, Kentucky today and warned that the fight against terrorism is far from over. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
The president was greeted by thousands of soldiers chanting USA, USA. He told them the United States and its allies have made a good start freeing Afghanistan from Taliban control, but he said the most difficult part is still to come because the terrorists are now hiding in heavily fortified caves.
The enemy hopes they can hide until we tire. But we're going to prove them wrong. We will never tire, and we will hunt them down.
The administration has warned that the campaign in Afghanistan could go on for a while. The president said the country appreciates the sacrifices being made by the military and their families. He had a Thanksgiving lunch with the soldiers at Fort Campbell, which is home to the 101st Airborne Division. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
In Portland, Oregon, police are refusing to help the FBI question Middle Eastern immigrants rounded up as part of the anti-terror campaign. Portland's acting police chief says the law doesn't allow him to arbitrarily question people whose only offense is an immigration violation. He says he can only interrogate people who are suspected of committing a crime. Nationwide, the FBI wants to interview some 5,000 men, but says they are not suspects. Most are from Middle Eastern countries, and the government says they might have useful information. According to the American Automobile Association, 5.8 million people in the Great Lakes region are expected to travel this Thanksgiving holiday weekend. From Chicago Public Radio, Jesse Hardman reports most are choosing their cars over flying.
AAA says 87% of travelers in the Great Lakes region will hop in their cars this Thanksgiving. That's around a 7% increase from past years. David Scholes is a travel expert at Northwestern University. Scholes says fear of flying has something to do with the change, but he says increased travel times due to security issues is the larger reason.
And you have to arrive at the airport 2 to 3 hours before your departure time. And then when you get to the airports, you've got to figure out a way to get your bags. It really becomes a no-brainer to hop in your car instead.
Aviation officials in Chicago say so far, air travelers have been moving smoothly through security checkpoints. They expect 1.2 million people to pass through local airports through the weekend. For NPR News, I'm Jesse Hardman in Chicago.
On Wall Street, the Dow closed down 67 points at 98.34. The Nasdaq fell 5 points, and the S&P was also off 5. This is NPR News. Famed lawyer F. Lee Bailey today was stripped of his license to practice law in Florida by the state Supreme Court. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
The man who represented O.J. Simpson and Patty Hearst was disbarred by the court because of the way he tried to control 600,000 shares of stock owned by another former client, a drug smuggler named Claude Dubac. Dubac was convicted in 1994. The shares were worth nearly $6 million at the time. The state said Bailey had only been given administrative power over the assets for a limited time, but when it tried to seize the shares back in 1996, Bailey refused to hand them over, treating the money, the court ruled, as if it were his own. He ended up spending more than 5 weeks in a federal prison until he changed his mind. In an unsigned opinion, the court ruled that Bailey was guilty of serious and basic trust account violations and disbarred him. He has 30 days to close his practice in Florida. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
In Washington, the Department of Education is reporting small amounts of anthrax spores in the agency's mailroom. It's believed to be a case of cross-contamination from the central post office that serves Washington. Officials describe the amount as low-level and say it's not considered dangerous to staff. The Bush administration is putting the nation's retailers on alert in the war against terrorism. The Environmental Protection Agency says merchants are being asked to report any suspicious sales of household chemicals. The concern is that those products could be converted into weapons that could be used by terrorists. Aid workers in Afghanistan say gunmen robbed a UN convoy in the western part of the country today and stole tons of food. Relief groups in several cities say they have had their offices looted with everything of value taken. I'm Mac Lee, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Audi, presenting Audi Assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This Thanksgiving, many Americans will be returning to their hometowns for family reunions. We're going to talk with Ken Wells about the place where he grew up, the Louisiana Bayou. As a senior writer and features editor for page one of the Wall Street Journal, Ken Wells collects stories about interesting and unusual people. His own story, growing up on the bayou, surrounded by more snakes and alligators than neighbors, is the basis of his two novels. His first novel, Mealy LeBove, is about a 15-year-old living on the bayou with his father, an alligator hunter who drinks a lot, often leaving Mealy to fend for himself. The kid who bullies Mealy, Junior Guidry, is the main character in Ken Wells' new novel, Junior's Leg. Set 12 years later, Junior is now a drunk, broke, ex-oil rig worker with a wooden leg. He lost his leg in an accident, boarding a rig in the shark-infested Gulf. Here's a reading in which Junior tells that story. I'll let Ken Wells introduce it.
This picks up with Junior basically being hung over, as Junior often is, and he's going off on his offshore shift where they work 7 and 7. It's pitch and rough out there. The Gulf is a big mess, and of course, he's going to work with his arch enemy, a guy named Armantaugh that he hates and who hates him. And of course, Armantaugh has just basically called him a sissy if he doesn't want to get up on that rig. And of course, Junior, being Junior, would never abide that. So he's going up one way or the other. I slam into the ladder and I know I busted my left wrist good, but I grab onto a rung with my right hand and I'm on the damn thing, even if it weren't purdy. I steady myself and reach up for the next rung. I don't even see the boat pitching my way on a big swell. I've got my right leg up on the next rung, but the crew boat pitches forward and bashes into the ladder, and there's a sound like the devil sawing on a tin roof. The bow catches my leg, and I hear every damn bone crack. I know my knee's been crushed like a bull redfish crushes a blue crab before it swallows it whole. The crew boat pitches down and rises up again, and I think the monster's just going to wipe me off the ladder like a mosquito slapped off the wall. But it misses me the second time and scrapes up against the fender of the rig, and I'm hanging there by one arm like a baboon, and some bastard is yelling, and the boat roars and finally backs away. A cloud of diesel comes blowing in my face. It's a damn good thing I'm as strong as I am. I'm hanging on, and I'm looking down at the water. I see something floating down there. The Gulf is rough and gray. Rough and gray as the sky, and then it's gray and red. There's a fire hose spraying red, and then I goddamn do know what I see down there. It's my leg.
Why did you want to start a novel with a grisly accident like this?
Well, first of all, grisly accidents like this happen down in the oil patch in Louisiana. You know, it's, you know, danger is a fact of life. Those jobs are really well paid, and they're often very sought after, but, you know, things like this, unfortunately, do happen. I also, you know, Junior, obviously, is a follow-up novel to my earlier novel about, you know, Mealy, a kid that Junior bullied. And so, this is 12 years later. And in a way, Junior is getting his comeuppance. You know, he's been a bad guy all of his life, and he's been a bully all of his life. And now he's being brought down a notch or two.
Yeah, so you took the character who was the bad guy from your first novel, the kid who bullied the main character, and you made this bully the main character of your second novel. Did you have to start seeing him in a more sympathetic light in order to frame a whole book around him?
Well, the idea all along was to try to save Junior from his sorry self, you know, and I think, you know, the whole notion of redemption runs through this book, and I just thought it would be interesting to try to take the bad guy and make something of him. Some of this is mildly autobiographical, too. You know, I cut my teeth as a cub reporter on the little paper down in Louisiana at around the time that Junior would have come of age, and every kid in high school, every boy in high school that I knew when I graduated in 1966 who wasn't going to college was going off to work the oil patch. And it was like going to the mines. You know, everyone did it. Everyone knew it was dangerous, dirty work. And yet there was a lot of money to be made. And kids coming out of high school were making $20,000 a year at some risk, of course. And so it just occurred to me that this is exactly where Junior would have ended up. And it was a way also of writing about that time and those issues.
So tell me more about the presence of oil in your world when you were growing up.
Well, I grew up in this little tiny place called Bayou Black, Louisiana, and it was a, you know, sort of Cajun enclave of about 200 families. Everybody of my mother's generation spoke French, you know, and certainly my grandmother's generation spoke nothing but French. Oil came in kind of early, but not really take off until the 50s, 60s, and 70s, where there was these sort of boom and bust cycles. And there's no doubt that it brought unparalleled, you know, economic prosperity to the place, but it also changed it eradicably in ways that, you know, it still is not, in my opinion, recovered from.
You know, reading your novels, they seem to be set in a different country. The novels even have glossaries in the back for Cajun terms that we might not know either what they mean or how to pronounce them.
Well, there are a lot of people who say politically Louisiana is a third world nation. You know, I love the place, first of all. But it is bedeviling in many ways. And one of the ways that it's bedeviling is that there is no sense of how we ought to deal with change and growth and economic development and oil. So as a result, there was this massive industry that came in and was able, in part through complicity, political complicity in Louisiana, to totally change the environmental landscape and the social landscape. And it really, in many ways, sort of rent the fabric of the community. I mean, Bayou Black, when I moved out there in 1957, I would say was a place that had not changed much in 200 years. I mean, Southdown Sugars, my dad worked for a sugar mill when he wasn't hunting alligators, and they still had a mule lot. They didn't totally trust the tractor in 1957. And by 1975, you know, because of growth and prosperity brought by oil, you know, there were subdivisions basically lapping at our farmstead out there, and it started to look like every other place in the world. So, you know, it definitely has left a mark in the place.
Would you physically describe Bayou Black when you were growing up?
Well, imagine a small town spread out, you know, along the opposing banks of a bayou that runs about 12 miles. The bayous basically were the distributaries of the mighty Mississippi River in that part of our state. And they took runoff, and of course, as they flooded, they built levees. And the floodwaters, Cajuns who came down there, settled those bayous in the late 1700s, always built their homes along the bayou bank because that was the high ground. So basically, you know, the bayous are simply communities stretched out along opposing bayou banks. And it didn't matter if you lived at one end of the bayou or the other end of the bayou. Basically, everybody started working for the oil industry, you know, people were mainly farmers or they were fishermen or they were trappers. You know, we lived next a mile or two away from Alligator Annie, who was a Cajun woman who ran had a bayou-side menagerie where she sort of collected swamp critters and showed them to tourists for a couple dollars and sold stuff to zoos. And there were six sons in my family, and my father, who had come from the swamps of Arkansas, immediately signed us up with Annie, and we started collecting snakes for her. And so I spent, instead of working in the 7-Eleven during my formative years, I was out tromping the fields. My Cajun grandmother was superstitious, and she was so opposed. See, my father was not a man of the Catholic faith, and all Cajuns are Catholic, so it was already a tragedy that, you know, my mother had married out of her faith. But now her grandsons were trafficking in a serpent. I mean, this was considered to be totally blasphemous. So one day when my dad was away at the sugar mill, seriously, my grandmother shows up with my uncle and my mother lines. It's all on the front, up on the front porch of our farmhouse. And my grandmother has gotten holy water from the church up in Thibodeau, and she sprinkles us all and says, "Those snakes are not going to get you now, boys." So.
Did you grow up having any superstitions or religious fears of snakes?
No, I love snakes. I early in my career, I wanted to be a herpetologist. I remember in eighth grade, I weighed about 82 pounds, and was 5'11". You know, so I was a beanpole. So I was not a good athlete, but I knew all about snakes. My father had taught us all about snakes. He wouldn't let us go hunt snakes without knowledge. So, you know, I'd bring snakes to school, and you know, the girls thought this was cool, and so I enjoyed my sort of tenure as the snake charmer of the eighth grade class. There's a beautiful snake down there. I know people say, well, snakes aren't beautiful, but there's a snake called the mud snake, and it's brilliantly shiny black on the back and flaming red on the belly. And it grows quite large. It can grow up to about 7 or 8 feet, actually. And they're very, very rare. But what its signature is that it has a vestigial horn at the end of its tail. And Cajun superstition held that if that snake stung an oak tree with its tail, the oak tree would die. And, of course, we were collecting a few of these snakes, and they would prod you with this thing, but it was inept. It wouldn't hurt you, and they were actually quite docile snakes. But when people found out we had mud snakes, they were mortified. They just thought, you know, you were just playing with fire, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Ken Wells. He's the features editor for page one of the Wall Street Journal. He's also a novelist, and his new novel is called Junior's Leg. That and his previous novel are set in the bayou of Louisiana. What does it look like now in the part of the bayou where you grew up?
Well, it's a sad thing for me. There are still beautiful, beautiful pockets of Louisiana, and again, you know, the Atchafalaya swamp water runs through my veins, and about the second thing I do when I get down there is get in a boat and go out on the bayou into the marsh or into the swamps. Usually I go fishing, but sometimes I just go looking, you know, and there still are hauntingly beautiful places. And the truth is, the ecosystem down there, people don't quite realize this, from the Mississippi River to the Sabine River in Texas, rivals the Florida Everglades. You know, it just never got the press that, you know, that the Everglades got. And, of course, it's been also sort of bastardized by development. But, you know, one of the saddest things, you know, to me, like it was sort of a story of what was to come, but... You know, we squirrel hunted every season, and I haven't picked up a gun in 25 years. But you know, I grew up in this family where my grandfather was a hunter and my father was a hunter, and squirrel hunting season to us was a ritual. You know, where we oiled up the guns and we shined up our hunting boots and we got the dogs ready, and it was always on the 1st of October, and the weather was always beautiful, and so I have these incredible memories. And you'd go at first light, and there would be fog in the top of the oak trees, and what I realized later is that what I really loved was being out there, you know, as you know, whether we got squirrels or not, even though my granny made a really great squirrel dumpling, I have to tell you, you know, if you ever had squirrel dumplings.
I have not.
But anyway, we would go out there. Well, there's this place that I hunted for probably 8 years going, and it was this beautiful, there was an old kind of slough that ran along the side of a cane field leading up to this big, beautiful ridge of oaks and then sort of tapering off into cypress swamp. And these trees must have been 200 years old, and they were just gorgeous. And you know, I would just, every opening day, I would end up under those trees when the sun came up, you know. And one year, I went back there, and they were putting in a subdivision, you know, full of house trailers. And the guy who was doing it, you know, had taken a D9 Caterpillar bulldozer and bulldozed down those trees to put in a sewage lagoon. And, I still haven't gotten over that. You know, it's the kind of thing that it should have never happened. You know, we should have had some modicum of zoning or planning. But, you know, to me, it was sort of criminal, you know. And we had this beautiful, beautiful place, and we just have not taken very good care of it, unfortunately.
My guest is Ken Wells. His new novel is called Junior's Leg. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ken Wells. He's features editor for page one of the Wall Street Journal, and he's a novelist. His new novel is called Junior's Leg. His first novel was called Mealy LeBove. They're both set in the bayous of Louisiana. How did you go from snake catching to journalism?
Well, that's pretty hilarious. I'm an accidental journalist. You know, I wanted to be what every boy who came of age around the 60s wanted to be, which is a rock star, you know. And my brother had bought a guitar from Sears, and, you know, and we were learning to play it. And I was in this failing rock band, and I was 19 years old. And I stepped aside from college, but I actually had flunked out of college. I was majoring in ping pong that semester. But anyway, I was desperate for a job, and I'm cruising the want ads of the little local weekly paper, and there's an ad saying part-time reporter wanted, you know, apply in person. So I show up down there, and luckily, you know, it was low pay and almost no standards. You know, I think it was $1.87 an hour, and are you willing to work 20 hours a week, and do you have a car? And then the last question was, let's see, Wells, now, would you be related to that guy, Catfish Willie Wells? And of course, that was my grandpa, Catfish Willie, as he was known in town. And, you know, it was one of those moments where it was kind of like a Clinton moment where, you know, what do you mean by grandpa? You know, because my grandfather was a character, you know, and you know, as I said, he was a really good fisherman and he was a really good drinker. And sometimes he would do both at the same time and get a real elevated opinion of his prowess. Well, the thing, it was the kind of little paper that, you know, he would catch these monster catfish. I'm serious. He one time caught a 52-pound flathead catfish on a cane pole in the middle of the town in a little place called off the Main Street Bridge. Well, anytime he caught a fish over 25 pounds, he'd ring up the newspaper and say, take my picture. And usually they would. And then if they didn't come promptly, you know, he'd drag the fish up the stairs and say, here I am. So here was a loaded question, you know, is that crazy old codger who drags these fish up our stairs your grandpa? And I said, well, he is my grandpa, he is. And John B. Gordon, who hired me and launched my career, bless his heart, said, you know, if you've got half the gumption of your grandpa, you can do this job. And so that was the beginning. My journalism career really is a fish story.
You know, there's so much about your life that is so different from mine growing up, you know, in New York. In the North, there's things that you've talked about that I have no comparable, you know, experience for. What was it like when you left the bayou and started working in cities? I think you were in Miami and then in New York. Did you feel like a foreigner?
I often felt like a foreigner, and I still sometimes feel like a foreigner. And you know, my favorite joke is that, you know, I decided to write my novels one day when I looked around the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal and realized I was the only person who'd ever skinned a possum, you know. but the truth is, you know, one of the things for me, and I think it happens to a fair number of people who write, is that I had to get out of there to be able to write about it. You know, I was too close to it while I was there. You know, it didn't occur to me, honestly, Terry, when I was 19 years old that I'd had an interesting childhood. I mean, there are a lot of kids down there whose fathers were alligator hunters, you know, and frog hunters and commercial fishermen, and who, you know, made their living partly off the land. And, you know, I kind of took good time in Cajun culture for, you know, all culture. So I think it actually took me a number of years, you know, away from the bayou before it occurred to me that, well, this is a strange place I grew up in. And I think when I finally had kids, my oldest daughter now is 19 and my youngest one is 14, but I realized, because, you know, as you say, I lived in Miami, I lived in San Francisco, I lived in London, and we were living all over, and now New York. And I realized that they would not have, you know, their childhood was going to be nothing like mine, and in fact, it would be impossible to recreate it in any meaningful way, just because the bayou has changed so much, and we are now citizens of the globe, and that sort of thing. So my first efforts to write about the place were really to sort of write down some of this stuff to give to my kids.
Well, you are features editor now for page one of the Wall Street Journal, and the Wall Street Journal is famous, among other things, for its feature stories on page one, which are usually a very colorful, often very odd, one-of-a-kind type of stories. What qualifies a story for placement on page one in the Wall Street Journal?
Well, for one thing, we like to do things that are that are fresh and have not been done. So, because we have a choice of the kinds of features. In other words, for instance, the New York Times does great stuff, but they're almost obligated to do stuff that's always on the news a lot of the times. And we can often kind of take a step back. And since we're not the paper of record when it comes to features, we can be a lot choosier. I think that's one thing. I think, the middle column of the front page is an institution, at least among journalism schools and journalism. It's a story that we like to say floats off the page every day and is quirky. And the whole notion of that, it was actually invented in the 40s by our legendary managing editor, a guy named Barney Kilgore. And a stock column used to run there. And instead, he decided that our beleaguered business readers needed, a break from that. And so started putting these kind of odd duck features. There was when I got to the San Francisco Bureau, there was a taciturn Texan named Ken Slocum, who was the Bureau chief, and there was a new reporter there. I joined at the same time as a woman named Carrie Dolan, and Slocum comes up to her and says, Carrie, I bet there's a chance that a person could get in a car in San Francisco and drive clear across the country for the night for the cost of a night in a fancy New York hotel. And that's $300, and you're going to do it. So Carrie Dolan had to get in a rental car and go across the country for under $300, and that became a legendary sort of feature story in the Wall Street Journal. They sent me off one time to Kodiak, Alaska, to do what? To cover a one-hole par 200 golf tournament up the side of a bear-infested mountain in the winter. So you can tell that there's a slightly twisted sensibility that's at work here. And, of course, we do very serious things, too. We do serious, I think, old-fashioned muckraking journalism as well. But altogether, I think the whole notion is to try to always be lively, always be fresh, and try to always be ahead, which is what most papers are trying to do anyway.
Well, Ken Wells, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Hey, this has been fun. Thanks for having me.
Ken Wells' new novel is called Junior's Leg. We recorded that interview a few days before September 11th, and we've been so caught up in covering the aftermath of the attacks that we haven't played the interview till now. The feature story on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal is about a class instructing shopping mall Santas how to answer kids' questions about terrorism. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, music from and music inspired by James Bond movies performed by the band Sex Mob. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wouldn't it be swell if James Bond really existed and could help root out the terrorists? Well, at least we have a new CD of James Bond music, eccentrically interpreted by the jazz band Sex Mob. The CD, Sex Mob Does Bond, opens with this Bond-inspired original composition, Dr. Yes, featuring John Medeski on organ and Kenny Wollison on drums. Dr. Yes was composed by my guest Stephen Bernstein, the trumpeter and leader of the band Sex Mob. Bernstein has been a longtime member and musical director of John Lurie's Lounge Lizards. He orchestrated, arranged, and conducted such film scores as Get Shorty, Kansas City, and Clay Pigeons. A review in Spin magazine said, "Sex Mob is all the fun that jazz, and lately rock, has forgotten to have." I love the James Bond music.
I do too.
It's got like big drama in it and these like sexy tango rhythms and stuff. What gets you about the music?
Well, it's all of that. It's exotic. You know, it's great when music can take you to another place. And I think one of the greatest things is that you can actually listen to these records and kind of imagine in your head a James Bond, just that whole larger concept of Bond. And you listen to these records, and John Barry's scores are just, they're melodically really strong, but there's also John Barry's a very interesting musician. He was one of the first musicians, he was a trumpet player, and he was one of the early composers that could successfully mix jazz music, classical music, and what was the beginning at that time of rock and roll or pop music. He had a combo that had two guitars in it, but they read music as opposed to... Usually when you hear electric guitars in music, they're improvising, they're playing rhythm parts, and his music always had written electric guitar parts, which is a very specific sound of a certain era, which I happen to love. And, you know, whenever you hear that doom 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 doom, really low in the guitar register, that's a real John Barry trademark.
Which Bond movies have you gone to where the music was most noticeable? Or do you love the music more from sitting home listening to your recordings from the soundtracks?
That is actually, I got to say, that's how I've learned to love the music most. Because it's interesting, I just watched Goldfinger with my son, and a lot of this music is from Goldfinger. And it's interesting how much of it gets ducked. See, when you score a film, they end up ducking a lot of the music, either for dialogue or for explosions and car crashes.
By ducking, you mean fading it out or covering it up?
Yeah, right. They have to bring the music down and then bring up the special effects at the end. So that's the last part of making a film, is they bring it all together on a soundstage, and they take the music and they bring it up and down according to like what else is happening. So if there's dialogue, they bring the music down. And again, especially in action films, there's a lot of car crashes, a lot of explosions, helicopter sounds, train sounds. All those things make the music come down. But when you actually listen to, you know, I have these score records on vinyl. You actually get to hear the entire piece, and you realize they're really beautiful pieces of music, too.
Each of the tracks have titles that relate to the part of the plot that the music is being played in. So I thought we'd play a track that's called Odd Jobs Pressing Engagement.
Can I just tell you, I just found out what that was because I just saw Goldfinger.
Yeah.
That's the scene where they've killed a guy and they've put him in the back of a car, and then the car gets compacted in one of those huge compactors.
Oh, pressing engagement.
Pressing,
I get it.
Engagement. Yeah.
Okay. So obviously this is from Goldfinger, and you hear the Goldfinger theme and the 007 theme weaving in and out of it. Tell me why you chose this track to do on your CD.
Every track I chose because I felt the melodies stood strong enough to be played in an individual manner. The pieces I felt could withstand what I call the sex mob treatment, which is that these melodies are going to be played literally, but they're also going to be stretched to their limits, and you know they'll be able to hold on and you know withstand the treatment.
Okay, well, let's hear the treatment of Ajab's pressing engagement from the James Bond film Goldfinger, and this is music from the CD Sex Mob Does Bond. Music from the CD Sex Mob Does Bond, and my guest, Stephen Bernstein, is the founder of Sex Mob. Stephen, talk a little bit more about the Sex Mob treatment when you choose a song to do.
Well, Sex Mob, and we've been together about 6 years, and now many people know us as a cover band, because when you come to hear Sex Mob, you probably hear songs by ABBA, James Brown, Prince, The Grateful Dead, Duke Ellington, The Rolling Stones, et cetera, what I call the 20th century songbook. It didn't start this way. It started off as like most bands in New York, you know, some extension of a person's ego when you have your music and your idea of what you want to do. And unlike most bands, we never rehearsed. We only played gigs. We started off having a weekly gig. And what I would do is I would show up kind of with a chart every week, or a couple charts, and we just play them live. We were playing at the Knitting Factory Tap Bar very late at night, from 11 to 2 in the morning every Thursday. And I had just started listening to Bond vinyl. I mean, it's kind of all goes, it's a circular thing here. And I had made a chart of this song called Bond with Bongos. And we started playing it, and it starts off with a long vamp. I originally used it because I thought it'd be a good vehicle for a drum solo at the end of the piece. And we start off with a kind of introduction and let the bass play a little bit. And we hit the James Bond theme, and suddenly this whole bar just erupts in like screaming and applause and this kind of general feeling of happiness. And I went, wow, this is great. I mean, here we are playing this totally unconventional style of music, and everyone just reacted in this great way. And I realized that if you play themes that people know, it doesn't matter how you play them because they can connect with them, even if you're like approaching them from a very, you know, unorthodox approach to playing music. And so I started searching for themes that were really strong and we could play in any way we wanted, because we tend to play songs different every time we play, that people would still recognize.
A lot of your repertoire comes from the 60s through the 80s. Are you doing more current songs?
We just added Britney Spears. Oops, I did it again.
Oh, really?
I love that song.
It's a really well-produced record.
To be honest, I haven't made it through the whole record. But it's a great little song. It's almost like a tango, you know. It's this kind of minor kind of rhythm. I mean, it's a minor melody, and the kind of rhythm is almost a tango rhythm. And, you know, we just started doing it on our last tour. And, you know, the thing is, it's hard to find a good, strong melody. And, you know, that's, like I said, that's what I'm looking for, is a melody that can withstand the force of Sex Mob.
You know, you had mentioned that at the Knitting Factory bar, when you were playing the James Bond theme, that people went nuts.
Yeah.
Now you do that on the new CD, in the track that you were mentioning, the Bond with Bongos.
Right.
And it's almost like a can-can version of the Bond theme. let me just play that.
Okay.
Why did you do the Bond theme in that manner?
I wish I could tell you there was an answer for this stuff, but it's just the way it happened.
You're very intuitive, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. The thing is, this is a working band. This band has worked for 6 years. This music is unrehearsed. I mean, it's all written. These are all charts, but I don't believe in rehearsing things. Well, I can't afford to, and it's allowed me to create a philosophy of not believing in rehearsing. And the beauty of that is what you get when you listen to one of my CDs is you get the first take of something. And I kind of feel there's so many CDs that come out now that it's, you want to have something special on your CD. And I think one of the great things to try to capture on tape is a feeling of something actually happening, which is that is musicians reacting to each other for the first time. Now, musicians tend to be very smart people. And obviously, if we're making CDs, we've been doing what we've been doing for a long time. So once you rehearse something once, then the musician starts thinking with the other side of their brain. They go like, you know what, when we get to this part, I'm going to do this. They're already thinking ahead. But if you get that first take where they're not even sure what the other musicians are playing, and they're constantly reacting, and maybe even making tiny mistakes, and then creating something new out of that, that's what you get on these CDs. And so, like I said, I can't really tell you why I chose that rhythm, but or why we did it that way. But basically, I probably just said, listen, we're going to start with a bass solo. You know, we're going to hit this theme, and we're going to end with a drum solo. And let's hit it and count it off. And that's what happened.
My guest is Stephen Bernstein, trumpeter and leader of the band Sex Mob. Their new CD is called Sex Mob Does Bond. We'll talk more and hear more music after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is trumpeter Stephen Bernstein. He's the leader of the group Sex Mob. Their new CD features music from and music inspired by James Bond movies. You play trumpet and slide trumpet. We think of a slide as being on a trombone, but not on a trumpet. What's a slide trumpet?
A slide trumpet is the precursor to the trumpet, and it's an instrument that's been around since before the trumpet, and nobody plays it except for me. And
what does it look like?
It looks like a... looks like a little trombone, but more handsome.
Why do you like to play it?
Well, there's a couple reasons. First of all, I gotta say, I've had one since 1977, and I say no one plays it, but actually a lot of people have them, and a lot of people do mess around with them, but no one has ever tried to actually create a language on the instrument. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've actually gone out there and made records only playing the instrument, and I go on the road, and I'm playing that instrument every night in front of audiences, and that's what no one's ever tried to do. And the great thing is it's a very vocal instrument, and there's always these things I was always hearing in my head when I played the trumpet. I'd hear Otis Redding, or I'd hear Jimi Hendrix playing the guitar, or I'd hear the way Burning Spear, I don't know if you listen to reggae music, but when Winston Rodney the singer from Burning Spear sings. He sings really high up on the pitch. And I would try to do these things on the trumpet, and it couldn't really do it because the way the trumpet is set up, it was really hard to push the instruments that way. And with a slide trumpet, it's so expressive that you can pull the notes in any direction.
So you can make something a little sharp or a little flat.
A lot sharp and a lot flat. I mean, that's the thing. It's an instrument that lends itself to large gestures.
And you can also get these raspberry kind of sounds on it.
Yeah, well, that's me. I mean, I don't know if everybody could get that, mm-hmm. but that's what I can get on that.
Right.
I mean, that's also part of my going back to the early tradition of brass playing, though. Those, what you call a raspberry sound, those growl sounds and those human sounds are part of the tradition of trumpet playing and of brass playing that's largely been lost. But if you go back to the 20s and the early 30s, there was a very vocal tradition of playing the brass instruments. And I got to say, while saying that, the great thing about the slide trumpet is it freed me from... See, when you play an instrument like the trumpet, you're almost like a prisoner of history, because always in your head, you're hearing Louis Armstrong, you're hearing Miles Davis, you're hearing Dizzy Gillespie, you're hearing Clifford Brown, you're hearing Lee Morgan, you're hearing like the greats, and you're always, in a sense, comparing yourself to them, and you have these three valves in front of you, and there's these things you've learned to do. And it's hard to free yourself from history. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
And here I have an instrument with no history. So in a sense, there's no right or wrong way to play this instrument. It's like whatever I do, if I can get away with it, it's okay. And it's been really freeing for me as a musician to be able to, like, I can play whatever I want when I pick this instrument up.
Let me play a track that I think it's fair to say shows off your slide trumpet playing. This is a track called Roswell. Stephen Bernstein on slide trumpet from the first Sex Mob CD. Their new CD is called Sex Mob Does Bond. You grew up in Berkeley, stayed in the Bay Area for, I don't know, through high school at least. I don't know about college. Mm-hmm. And you ended up in New York. When you got to New York, you fell in with the John Zorn and the music scene that he was helping to create. Did it change your direction at all to meet the group of musicians in New York that you played with?
No, because actually they were the logical extension of what we were doing in Berkeley. I was really lucky that growing up, there was a guy named Phil Hardiman, a great teacher who died a couple years ago. And he started a jazz program along with Dick Whittington and Herb Wong in 1969, where they started... fourth graders improvising. And in fourth grade, we had jazz band. And a lot of great musicians have come through that program, one of them being Peter Applebaum, who I've been playing music with since I was in fifth grade and he was in sixth grade. And Peter started a band called the Berkeley Free Jazz Unit. And we were, 14 years old. And it was a band of 14 and 15-year-olds based on the Art Ensemble Chicago and Alfred Eiler. And the great thing is, by the time we got to high school, we used to get together and do like these long, free get together after school and improvise for hours. And all summer we'd improvise every day. And in high school, we actually gotten really good at this, and we put on concerts. And of course, you know, all the girls would come to the concerts because we were these musician guys. And then, of course, all the jocks would come to the concert because the girls were there. So in Berkeley, you had this great scene of, like, you know, the swim team and the baseball team coming to hear these, you know, hour-long concerts of free improvisation. I mean, it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. So when I met John and, I mean, the first people I met were the Microscopic Septet. And at that time, John Zorn was playing alto saxophone with him, and it was at the Ear Inn, and it was a Sunday afternoon, and Elliot Sharp was sitting in, and Wayne Horvitz was hanging out, and Bobby Previtt was hanging out. And kind of like in one afternoon, I met, like, that whole scene, and I immediately fell in with them because they were playing the kind of music that I was attracted to, and they weren't that much older than me. We had a lot in common. And, you know, I was already a kind of guy, I could play free improvisation, but I could also read music, and I had a lot of, or some understanding of jazz tradition to be continued.
My guest is Stephen Bernstein, trumpeter and leader of the band Sex Mob. Their new CD is called Sex Mob Does Bond. We'll talk more and hear more music after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is trumpeter Stephen Bernstein. He's the leader of the group Sex Mob. Their new CD features music from and music inspired by James Bond movies. Now, I want to play a track from a CD that you made a couple of years ago, and this was a CD that was made for the musician and composer John Zorn's series called Radical Jewish Culture. And the CDs in that series have ranged from klezmer music to just kind of out there music that's composed by Jewish musicians. What's your interpretation of the Radical Jewish Culture series that Zorn started?
My interpretation of that is that it's John's way. John is really an amazing human being. And it's John's way of giving each musician an assignment. And that assignment is, what is this music to you?
So what was your idea?
Well, my idea was that the Jewish melodies are not that different than, there's a certain harmonic progression to these beautiful minor, these ancient Jewish melodies, and that's basically a 1-5-1, we call 1-5-1, or a 1-4-5-1 progression, which is the same progression you find in New Orleans, you know, all these, like, New Orleans rock and roll songs, and the same thing you hear it if you listen to, like, traditional, like, Cuban singers singing over, when they just sing over rumbas. They sing these melodies, these ancient, these also old melodies. And I realize there's this, like, all these melodies are almost the same. But the thing is that Jewish music doesn't really, there's not really a rhythm. There is an internal rhythm to Jewish music, but Jewish music isn't really done with drums. It's kind of sung freely with an internal rhythm. And I realize, well, these melodies are almost the same. These harmonies are the same. If I start using these rhythms that are part of my life, like who I am. Because, see, I didn't come up playing klezmer music or listening to klezmer music. I came up listening to jazz music and listening to R&B music and listening to salsa music and listening to Cuban rumberos and listening to music from New Orleans. And that's my music. That's who I am. So I figured I need to play music in my rhythms, the rhythms that make me comfortable. And I realized that these rhythms from this music and the harmony that naturally goes with this music also fits these ancient melodies. There's a natural combinations of all these musics. And I figured I could take this music, these melodies I've known since I was a little kid. I mean, even though I wasn't a super religious Jew, we went to temple you know, fairly often, and we celebrated the holidays and we celebrated the Sabbath. And you grow up hearing these songs, and we had a great, beautiful cantor in Berkeley, a real older guy, a real classic cantor with a lot of hair coming out of his ears. And these melodies were inside of me, and then these rhythms were inside of me too. So I combined them all. I combined this kind of New Orleans rhythm section with the electric piano and the bass, and I combined the clave rhythms and the drums, and then I put these Jewish melodies on top of them.
Well, let me play Chusin Challah Mazel Tov.
That's the one everybody loves.
So tell us a little bit about the traditional song and what you've done with it.
Well, I mean, it's really funny. I mean, I came up with this playing a wedding. Chusin Challah Mazel Tov means Mazel Tov to the bride and groom, and it's a song you play at every Jewish wedding. And he usually goes, ba 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 do 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 do. Very fast, you know, and people dance very fast in a circle. Actually, that's not a circle. They dance around the bride and groom who are sitting in a chair.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized I was kind of like sitting by myself, kind of working out the melody, you know, and I was playing with like a plunger mute, I think, kind of playing like, yo, meow, meow, meow. And I realized, man, you could play this like, this really fits right into that kind of whole New Orleans tradition. And then I took that and kind of, instead of doing the New Orleans jazz tradition, I kind of put it in the New Orleans rock and roll tradition. I mean, it's kind of almost like a classic, what I would call like a Dave Bartholomew style arrangement. He did all these great rock and roll arrangements. He was Fats Domino's arranger. He was a trumpet player, is a trumpet player. He's still alive in New Orleans. And when you hear the track, you'll hear what I mean. It's pretty self-explanatory.
Well, Stephen Bernstein, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
What, Derry Gross, you rock.
Music from Stephen Bernstein's CD Diaspora Soul. His band Sex Mob has a new CD called Sex Mob Does Bond. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a good Thanksgiving.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publishers of Stephen Hawking's The Universe in a Nutshell, the sequel to A Brief History of Time. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, for Thanksgiving, we feature highlights of the three concerts we've presented since September 11th with Nick Lowe, Loudon Wainwright, and Dan Zanes. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.